Welcome to tonight's quarterly debate. It's called a men's summit, and we do these because it's hosted by the men's ministry of Reston Bible Church. If you are new to Reston Bible Church, you've never been here before, we're delighted that you're here. We want you to know that our senior teaching pastor is Mr. Jim Supp, and we would really welcome you to come in on a Sunday morning. We have services at 9 o'clock a.m. and 10:45. Jim teaches through the Bible. I think you'll find that very both inspiring as well as educational, so we encourage you to consider that. And a few administrative items. The bathrooms for men and women that haven't been here before, you just go out the lobby and turn right. Just turn right, and you'll find them as you go down the hallway. And then take your phones out and put them on silent. Please, if you haven't done that, put them on silent. I was teaching a seminar once. Told people to do that. I didn't do it myself. My phone went off while I was teaching. And I stood there thinking it was someone in the audience. It was highly embarrassing. So I want to make sure you put your phone on silence. This debate this evening is going to be recorded, and it will be online on the Reston Bible Church main website. You'll find that by Thursday evening. This Thursday evening, it will be posted by then. Please withhold any and all applause until the debate is concluded. And please do not be shouting out any comments, positive or negative, towards any towards either of the people debating this evening. If there is a outburst, I will kindly approach you and ask you to go out into the lobby outside of the auditorium here. And I'd prefer not to do that. Tonight's summit is a debate between former Christian minister and author of Why I Became an Atheist, John W. Loftus, and then Scott Tomlinson, a strategic thinker for the U.S. government and board member of Reasonable Faith. And that is an organization by Dr. William Lane Craig. Scott is also a longtime facilitator of a class we have at 9 o'clock here called Solid Ground. And so let's give them a warm applause for their thorough preparation and for being here. I want both of you men to know that this is one of the most mature, most highly educated, and civil audiences you'll ever debate in front of. So this is a great place to hold something like this. You know, when you can take debating, and it goes back centuries. When you look into the scriptures, even the Apostle Paul, if you look in the book of Acts, was debating philosophers about Jesus in Athens, and you can find other examples of it. So this is something that's very common. And I can tell you with what goes on in our culture today that this is one of the best places to hold a debate. And again, John, I just want to really thank you on behalf of everybody at Reston Bible Church for coming tonight. We're grateful to have you. And again, Scott, I know you got a full schedule. Thanks for your preparation and for coming this evening. Our moderator this evening is Mr. Will Gaines. Will is a mortgage banker, and he and his family live out in Haymarket, Virginia. Will has been a longtime friend of the ministry here. And he will cover the details of the debate for you right after I pray. So if you'll just bow your heads with me, please, I'd be grateful. Heavenly Father and Lord Jesus Christ, we are so thankful for the many hardworking and generous people that have allowed us to have a facility and building like this so that good events like this can take place. You know, many of us here already believe in you. We're already convinced that you're Lord of all, that you're risen. And there are others who are uncertain, and there are others who are certain that you don't exist. And even in the last two categories of people, I pray that you would just open their minds to hear what's said this evening and to just be like others and really consider what conversation goes on and that you would reveal yourself to them. I thank you for the audience, the people that have come out on a Monday night after work and the students that have come and just appreciate knowing that this event will be very well responded to, and we thank you again in Jesus' name. Amen. Will?
Thank you, Pastor Bruce, and thank you again to Reston Bible Church for agreeing to host this event, and it's my pleasure and honor to be the moderator here this evening. You know, it's my personal belief that the question that the participants will be debating tonight, does God exist, is the first and foremost we all must address in our spiritual journey for truth, and its implications could not be more significant. So with that in mind, thank you again, Mr. John Loftus and Scott Tomlinson, for agreeing to participate. The total time frame for tonight's debate is going to be approximately 2 hours, and the format's going to be as follows. We're going to have 25 minutes for each participant for opening statements, and then we'll have 10 minutes for each participant for rebuttals, followed by 20 minutes for facilitated conversation and 7 minutes for closing statements. After that, we'll have approximately 16 minutes for Q&A, where audience members can come up. If you have a question for Mr. Tomlinson, you can come up to this microphone over here. For Mr. Loftus, for this microphone over here. And we'll try and rotate them so each participant is able to engage as much as possible with the audience. At that time, and I'll remind you at that time, please come up with a question and try and be as concise as possible. Don't come up with a thesis. We have limited time, and we want to give everybody an opportunity as much as possible. So with that in mind, thank you again, everybody, for coming. Without you guys here, this doesn't happen, and we appreciate you coming and being a part of this. And Scott is going to be arguing in the affirmative, so he will lead off. Mr. Tomlinson, the microphone is yours.
Thank you, Will. Am I audible? Okay, good. Thank you, John, for coming out. We really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing the stage. Okay, let's see if the clicker works. Here's the big mystery. Good. Okay. We're here to talk about, debate the proposition, does God exist? And would like to set a little bit of at least how I plan to do most of the talk tonight, or my portion of it. First off, in any situation where you're planning on talking with somebody that doesn't hold your viewpoint, you should use shared standards, standards that both sides agree are good, solid standards. So you won't hear me do any faith-based reasoning tonight. You won't hear any God of the Gaps reasoning. You will hear logic. You will hear reason. You will hear deductive arguments, inductive arguments. You'll hear me talking in terms of probability. And then we'll talk about evidence. If it's not an evidence claim, then if it's not a mathematical or purely logical proof, you're going to need evidence for it. And there are multiple types of evidence, of course, but let's go with the most accepted. And where we can use empirical evidence, where we can use scientific evidence, we should use those. Where we can use mathematical proofs, we should use those as well. So very briefly, just in desire to scare the audience, I put an equation up there. Don't worry, that's simply Bayes' rule, which basically is, what is evidence? So evidence are data that make a proposition more likely to be true than it would be just based on the background information alone. So if somebody says that I killed somebody, that's the background information. If you find a gun at the crime scene with my fingerprints on it, those data make it more probable that I'm the killer than it would be based on the background evidence alone. And this is now considered very broadly among the scientific disciplines to be a very standard definition of evidence. So just for background. Okay, we'll talk, let's get directly into some arguments. So both of us are up here on either sides of the proposition. It's my job to make arguments that show God does exist, and John will make arguments to show God does not exist. So this is also a fairly standard argument, but it is in three premises, or two premises and a conclusion. If the universe, and the universe in this case, the word we're using here, means all space, time, matter, and energy. This applies equally to the multiverse, if there's such a thing as a multiverse. But if the universe began to exist, then the universe has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. And three, therefore, the universe has a cause. So let's look first at premise one and decide if it's true. In order for an argument to be a good argument, it has to be in a valid form. A valid form would be something like modus ponens, or if P, then Q, P, therefore Q. And this is in one of those forms. And the second would be, is are each of the premises more likely true than their negation? So we're looking to see if they're more plausibly true than their negation, which is a fancy way of saying, are you using true premises? So on the first premise, it shouldn't be that controversial. It's just the causal principle. So the causal principle says if something begins to exist, then it had a cause. That is to say, is if there's an effect, there's a cause. That things don't just pop into existence uncaused out of nothing. Without the causal principle, I would note, you basically cannot be a scientist, because if you're going to mix together sodium and chlorine and then act surprised that salt came out of it and say, like, I don't know, perhaps it came uncaused out of nothing, that doesn't make you a scientist. It makes you something a little bit closer to a magician or possibly a lunatic or both. I guess you could be both. If you believe in science, you do believe in the causal principle, because science's job is to look for what's the cause of something to such a degree that you can predict what will happen in the future. That's really the goal of the scientific method, is to be able to make accurate predictions in naturalistic regimes. It's also, of course, the most successful metaphysical principle of all time, which is goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks, but it is out of nothing, nothing comes, which is a good pithy way of saying if you have an effect, you have a cause somewhere. Things don't just pop into existence uncaused out of nothing. So premise one is really shouldn't be that controversial. Premise two also, I don't believe, is very controversial, that the universe began to exist. So the evidence for this, I really, maybe you could say, are in two parts. The first, I've put up the James Webb Space Telescope, the cosmic microwave background radiation maps that you got out of COBE and out of the Wilkinson-Michelson anisotropy probe. So you get some of those data out there, but for a very long time you have heard about the Big Bang through your whole education. This idea of an expanding universe, this correlation between Cepheid variable stars, type 1a supernovae, the novae, the kind of standard candles that are out there in cosmology, have led us to believe with almost universal certainty that the universe began to exist, and not only began to exist at a certain point in time. We can run kind of the model backwards and see it. It is so widely accepted in cosmology that it's literally called the standard model of cosmology. So you'll see I pulled a quote up here, and this is from Professor Stephen Hawking, and this is an old quote, so let me note that, because I'll talk about some more recent data of his. This one was back in the 80s, but he and Hartle had come out with the singularity theorems, and at the time, this was more meaningful perhaps than it is today, but all the evidence seems to indicate, all the evidence, that the universe has not existed forever, but had a beginning about 15 billion years ago. So you can tell it's a little bit dated by the date that he has on there. There's further to the cosmological evidence. This is observational evidence that we see through our telescopes. You'll also have mathematical proofs, like Arvin Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander von Lincoln put together a mathematical proof that shows basically if the universe is expanding on average, then it had to have started from a single point in the past, or something like that. So this right here, John, I think, rightly notes that some apologists talk about that last quote as though Hawking had not made any pronouncements since then. But he has actually, he came up with another theorem along with James Hartle called the no-boundary condition. And the no-boundary condition changes a little bit of how we think the universe began to exist, or at least how Hawking and Hartle and others think the universe began to exist. But he said this to Neil deGrasse Tyson, you can find this on YouTube, on Star Talk in 2018, which was the year that he passed, at least this was the year that was published. He says, in other terms, as Hawking speaking, the Euclidean space-time is a closed surface without end, like the surface of the Earth. One can regard imaginary and real time as a beginning of the South Pole, which is a smooth point of space-time where the normal laws of physics hold. And here's the important portion of it. There is nothing south of the South Pole, so there was nothing around before the Big Bang. So Hawking, even in 2018, believes that there was a Big Bang and that there was nothing around before it. If you're into this, hang on for, give me 30 seconds. If you're not into this, think about something else for 30 seconds. this is actually from James Hartle's presentation. But this, I don't know that this is going to work well. Yeah, the laser pointer is not going to work. You can see this form right here. It says EUC, LOR, this is Euclidean space and Lorentzian space. And there's a line there that says match. So what Hawking and company have done was he used a special kind of calculation using Feynman's integral over infinite paths and a principle of least action to basically say, is there a way that we can model the early universe that gets rid of the singularity? And it turns out that there's a way to do that in quantum mechanics, and some of it naturally emerges from the Schrodinger waveform that shows that a natural kind of transition happens in the probability amplitudes at a place where the radius of the universe, when it's super, super tiny, like subatomic size, is at the square root of 3 over lambda, the cosmological constant. So what he basically does is he cuts it off mathematically and then builds imaginary time at the bottom. So he uses a imaginary time calculation for a Euclidean 3 space, and then he projects it onto a Lorentzian 4 space to get the de Sitter universe we find ourselves in. If you're into the technical stuff, there you go. If you're not into the technical stuff, welcome back. I'll go to the next part. And it basically looks like this. This is Hawking's universe on the left. This is what happens when you pull the imaginary time out of it on the right. You get the singularity back. But in either case, you'll notice that it has a left bound. That point that's the South Pole, that's the beginning of the universe. Hawking says time starts at the line because he rolls time back into a spatial dimension prior to that. But the spatial dimension expands, time-like spatial dimension expands, and it still moves from left to right. So the universe still has a beginning at the Big Bang. And the bottom line is you need something to cause for it to exist, because otherwise it came into existence out of nothing. So what does this argument give us? Well, if it, whatever the cause of the universe is, happens before there's time, so it has to be timeless. It happens before there is space, so it has to be spaceless. It happens before there's mass energy or matter and energy, so it has to be immaterial. It brought all of this into existence, so it has to be enormously powerful. And ultimately, this is kind of an important but an odd point, it is very plausibly personal. And the reason it's personal is if whatever the cause was existed forever, and it was kind of a universe-creating cause, the universes would continue to be created all the time. If it was off, it wouldn't create anything. So something has to switch the switch, so to speak, from on to off. So there has to be a choice in there. Something has to choose to move it from one to the other. Quantum mechanical systems don't do that. Any quantum mechanical system that lasts a very long time will never generate a perturbation like that. Ones that will generate these kinds of perturbations are very short, temporally speaking. Okay. Hopefully that's the most technical argument that you'll hear for a while. Let me talk about a second argument, and this is an argument from design. This is Sir Fred Hoyle, who said, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests the super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as the chemistry and biology, and there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Rather than accept the fantastically small probability of life having arisen through the blind forces of nature, it seems better to suppose that the origin of life was a deliberate intellectual act. Professor Richard Dawkins, a fairly strident atheist, said organized complexity cannot spontaneously happen. Now, he said this in a particular context. And what he's talking about is complexity doesn't arise all at once. Evolution by natural selection is the only known process whereby organized complexity can ultimately come into being. Now, remember this quote. And then Francis Crick, co-discoverer of DNA, said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved, which is an interesting quote to me for a number of reasons. So the fine-tuning of the universe, and I'll talk about that in a second, the fine-tuning of the universe, which I guess I'll talk about now, there are about a dozen constants and quantities in physics that without which you wouldn't get the universe that we see here. So if things like the gravitational constant were slightly bigger or slightly smaller, stars and galaxies couldn't form or hold together. There are a dozen of those, and a lot of that in your extracurricular time, if you want to research it, there's a lot of information on that out there. I won't go into it for technical reasons tonight. But the fine-tuning of the universe is due either to necessity, chance, or design. It is not due to necessity or chance, and therefore it's due to design. So why do we think that? Well, and why do those gentlemen who had quotes earlier, why do they think that the universe either is designed or at least looks designed? And the answer is stuff like this. So I picked kind of the most salient point here. So Roger Penrose talks about the low entropy condition, which is basically how organized did the early universe have to be in order to get the universe that you see today. And he says that that is down to one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power. That number is incomprehensible. So that's an exponent to an exponent, so that's a 10 with more zeros after it in an exponent form than there are protons, neutrons, and electrons in the universe. So if you literally wrote zeros on everything, you still wouldn't have gotten the number. That's how improbable it is. Apologists usually don't talk about it in those terms. What they talk about is it's one chance and whatever else. So if we're asking, I think John rightly identifies that we should reason in terms of probability. This is the most annoying slide in the deck, hopefully. That what that means is that since it's either chance or design, since nobody argues that the universe is this way necessarily, it's either chance or design, the probability that this is down to design is 99.99999 repeating percent all the way out until you've written a 9 on every proton, neutron, and electron in the universe. So if you believe in logic and you believe in scientific bases for probability judgments, then you've as close to certain as you can be of anything that the universe was designed. Now let's talk about maybe a little more comprehensible, closer version of this. A lot of times you'll hear, and we're not talking about evolution here, this is before evolution, so just the first self-replicating form of life. And let's say it's relatively simple, just 2,000 proteins long, total necessary to do it. The average protein is something like 300 amino acids long. Let's talk about one just half that size. We hear a lot about hydrothermal vents, and this stuff could have just happened possibly at the bottom of the seafloor. If you filled the, if you emptied the oceans and filled the entire Earth 2 miles deep in just amino acids, and exactly the 20 amino acids that you need for life, and you had them connect with each other a million times a second for 4.6 billion years, the chance that you'd get one functional protein of length 150 amino acids is one in a billion. You need 2,000. And they need to be twice that length, which increases it exponentially. In short, this is just not reasonable. This level of improbability is, for anybody who's willing to be open-minded, is difficult for me to understand why they would bite on that. Now, of what truths can we be the most certain? In my mind, they're logical truths, things like 2 plus 2 equals 4, or square circles. Nobody has a grant right now looking for married bachelors, because we know there can't possibly be any. In the same way, we know that no matter what world is out there, 2 plus 2 is going to equal 4 in any of them. For this reason, I happen to think that logical proofs are the best, so I will give you a purely logical proof at this time. And the logical proof is in two parts. The first premise is, let me tell you what a maximally great being is. A maximally great being is a being who has all great making properties. So if goodness is a great making property, this being would have it. A conceptual being would have that goodness to a maximal degree. If power is a great making property, it would have power to the greatest degree. So a maximally great being, which is a concept, it is possible a maximally great being exists. That's premise one. Premises two through four are actually not controversial among philosophers. This is a modal system called S5. It's just basically considered good math. Modal logic is basically like algebra. It's a branch of mathematics. Modal logic is a branch of logic and of philosophy. So the argument runs like this. It's possible a maximally great being exists. If it's possible a maximally great being exists, a maximally great an MGB exists in some possible world. If it exists in some possible world, then it exists in all possible worlds. And if it exists in all possible worlds, then it exists in the actual world, because the actual world just has a possible world. Therefore, an MGB exists. So what this argument actually shows is that a maximally great, if it's even possible a maximally great being exists, then it is because a maximally great being exists necessarily as part of the definition of what a maximally great being is, a part of what the concept is, then it is certain that a maximally great being exists. John has admitted and said that he thinks it's possible God exists, so this argument would go through and John would therefore believe that God exists. Well, presumably he'll have some comment on that later. John does actually object to this one, both on the grounds that Immanuel Kant showed that existence is not a property.
You read my book.
I did. I read your whole book. I read all your books. However, I think he misses the part where Hegel comes back later and says, while existence is not a property, necessary existence is a property. So philosophers have acknowledged that change post-Hegel. In why I became an atheist, John says that planting his argument, which is a formulation I just gave you, if valid, would work for a maximally evil being. But since the ontological argument can be used to prove two mutually exclusive beings both exist, the reasoning is itself faulty. So what's the flaw in this objection? Anybody know? Evil is not a great making property, so you can't use this argument to prove an evil being would exist. Okay, I'll do this one quickly. This one to me is the most intuitive of the arguments. If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. This is not philosophically controversial. Objective moral values do exist, and therefore God exists. What do we mean by objective? Objective values are moral values that exist, whether anybody believes in them or not. So I'll tell you whether or not you believe in God just based on this statement. If the Germans, the Nazis, won World War II and succeeded in killing or exterminating everybody that disagreed with them, so that everybody in the world now thinks is now a Nazi, and they all believe that it's okay to commit genocide, if you think that's still wrong, then you believe in objective truth, because subjectively they have established that it's no longer bad to kill Jews in ovens. It's good. So if you think that that's false, then you believe in objective moral values. And if you believe in objective moral values, then you actually believe God exists by this argument. So I spent the majority of time, and both the clocks have gone down. I don't know how much time I have left. So I will may have to do this, John, in two. I may do some of the rebuttal with it.
6.5 minutes.
6.5 minutes, okay. I would like to talk, I hope to hold a little more time for this because I think this is something John would like to talk about more. He's written his most recent book on the problem of horrendous suffering. And so I wanted to talk about the problem of evil and suffering. I'll try to do this quickly. The logical problem, John will tell you, has been solved, but the probabilistic problem, like why would a God allow as much evil and suffering as we see in the world? So if we ask, could we be living in the best of all possible worlds? That's actually a contention I'd like to make tonight, is that the world, the best of all possible worlds, very much would look like this. That sounds controversial, but I'll explain what I mean by that. So let's ask, if we're going to criticize God on it, let's try it ourselves. So let's build a perfect world. What does a perfect world have to have as the number one characteristic? Love. Love's got to be the number one characteristic. What do you have to have if you're going to have love? You have to have free will. Robots can't love each other. You have to have somebody to be able to choose it. Why? Because love is a selfless, benevolent regard for somebody else. So love requires moral agents that have free will in order for love to exist at all. And people with free will, they can choose good or evil, so you may end up with people who are either good or evil. Now, what are the four categories of people who might exist if you have free will? And we'll split up the group here. You have people who will always be good in any possible world. You guys get to be that one. This half, these are people who are contingently good if you don't see any evil. So if we don't spoil you, you'll be just fine. The other half of the audience are people who would be good if they get to see and experience evil. I'll talk to you guys in a second. You guys are always evil. Nothing I can do about you. Let's talk about this group right here, the contingently good if they experience evil. Have you ever had a kid or seen a kid who mom and dad say, don't touch the stove? What are they going to do? They reach out and touch the stove, and eventually they realize, you know what, maybe mom and dad gave me that order not because they want to be tyrants, but because it's actually good for me. You've got the slightly wiser or less courageous brother or sister who watches that happen and says, oh, okay, noted, that's bad. Maybe there's a good reason to obey this good authority. I think most of us are this group. I think that we have to do evil in order to become good. Why is this relevant? If we're going to build the world, the best possible world, and we only build the people who are going to be good if there's no evil, we only get half of all possible people. What if, is that the best possible world? No, I can think of a better world. What if we could get 2/3? That's the best possible world. But what does that mean? That means you have to do this. You have to have a two-phase world, a rescue phase and a perfection phase. The always good people, you can have them around anytime you want. They're always going to be good. The always evil people, you got to get rid of them by the time that your perfect world rolls around. Your contingently good people, just put them in your perfect world. Don't let them be brought down. But your contingently good people, you don't get those unless you have this world that has evil in it. And that's one of the reasons that we would have such a world. Is there any empirical support for this? I ran a 1,000-person survey on Mechanical Turk, and I asked the following question. Would you rather live in a world with no evil, but in which you have to obey a good authority all the time, or would you rather live in a world that had evil, but you can choose to do what you want? Half the people, statistically speaking, said we'd rather live in an evil world. So look next to your left and right. 3 minutes. If you were in the biblical Garden of Eden, I asked this one, because John, I think, you know, not wrongly asked the question of, like, didn't God just set Adam and Eve up for a failure there? If they knew what they were getting into, they wouldn't have chose that way. So I asked these 1,000 people, if you were in the biblical Garden of Eden, would you eat the fruit if it would give you the knowledge of good and evil, even if God told you not to do so, and presuming you know what happens? And 38% of people said, yeah, I'd do it anyway. So again, look to your left and right. One of those people is the problem. Good reasons for allowing evil. Why allow evil? Love. Love means you have to allow evil as a possibility. Making the best possible world. So enduring evil from some people, that third group, will result in their eventual conversion to good, resulting in a greater number of people in the perfect world. Imagine you could see your children in the future. Would you want to see a child that you could have and say, like, I'm not willing to put up with an evil myself. I'll just let them not be actualized. That doesn't seem like a perfect world. It doesn't seem like what a loving God would do. Justice, this is important, by the way. If God just said, well, I'll create you all, and you guys over there, you're good, you're going to be fine. You guys, you would have done terrible stuff. Well, if I wouldn't want to be judged without having actually done it. And I think that's important. Part of allowing the world to have evil in it shows people who are the good and who are the evil. And as an example, Hitler could have made that protest. But now nobody wonders whether Hitler would be good or bad, do they? Because we watched what happened. So a perfect world requires love, which requires freedom to do good or evil, which for some requires time to learn from evil to become good, which is necessary to have the maximum number of people living in a perfect world, which is the kind of world a perfect God would create. This world has exactly these properties, if you notice, by the way. This is what this world looks like. And it has it, interestingly, based on that survey, in similar proportions. To my mind, that means that there's good reason to believe that not only is it possible or even plausible that there's a God behind this world, but rather, if we tried to make the best possible world on our own, we would end up designing a world that looks very much like this, as long as you understand that this world is phase one of a two-phase world. So, if that makes sense to you, good, because it made sense to me. And with that, I'll turn it over to John.
Thanks, Scott. He's amazing. He just really is amazing. He quotes my words back on me. I hate him. I'll try to get to those later. But to believe in a God who created the universe doesn't automatically lead believers to their own particular specific religious sect. Muslims, Jews, Catholics, mainline Protestants, conservative evangelicals, snake handlers, progressives, liberals, and even deists all agree that there's some kind of God. The truth is there is an utterly overwhelming number of non-Christian religionists who agree that a different creator God exists, just not Scott's evangelical kind. So God arguments are really beside the point if we want to debate something interesting. None of those arguments, even if shown to be true, point to a specific religion or religious sect or a God. And so until Scott can do that, I don't really need to respond to them, but I will as the day goes on. I mean, I know it's not a day, but as the time goes on. You hear my point so far, right? Let's say God exists. You know, even an atheist like me can say it's possible, but that doesn't mean that it's probable, and we'll get to that too. Now, you're here tonight because you believe in the Bible. My main counterclaim is that if you really understood the Bible, you wouldn't claim such a thing or believe in a God, the Bible's God. Here we go. I hope you didn't come in entertained, because I'm going to tell you some really hard-nosed facts. So does the God of the Bible exist? That's the real question. Now, I'm going to run through a few of these slides, and I'm telling you why, because I'm going to come back to them later. I want to focus on some things, and my PowerPoint is way too long for the time I have, so I have to skip some slides, and when I do, don't worry about it. It's necessary. What is almost always overlooked in debating the existence of the Christian theistic God is that such an entity has had a complex evolution over the centuries from Elohim to Yahweh to the God Jesus and then to the God of the philosophers, the one he just argued for, without asking if the original gods had any merit. Atheist philosophers of religion try to dispute the existence of a Christian God by arguing against philosophical proofs put forth. That's what I'm supposed to do here. This is okay as it goes, but it overlooks the fact that Christians will just invent different conceptions of God, despite the fact that these new conceptions are foreign to the ones we find in the Bible. There's a better approach. It's the one that changed my mind from a former Christian apologist to an atheist, and I can't answer these arguments. That's why I'm an atheist, and I'm going to present to you today. It involves taking the Bible seriously. What this means is that if you really want to understand the Bible, you shouldn't try to dismiss it depending on what you think it should say. Rather, you should honestly try to understand what it does say. Agreed? Unfortunately, when it comes to the Bible, Christians take it literally until the literal interpretation becomes indefensible. Then they find some other meaning, no matter how strange. In other words, it says what it says until refuted by reason, morality, and or science. Then it says something other than what it says. Tonight I'll explain a few Bible passages in an attempt to help listeners understand them without recourse to skepticism or anti-supernaturalism. Okay. Is that good? Dr. Gehrke has PhDs in philosophy of religion and in Old Testament, and he's given me some germs to run with tonight in an article called "Can God Exist If Yahweh Doesn't?" And he says, if you read the scriptures and are not shocked out of all your religious beliefs, you have not understood them. So we're going to go through some of these gods. First, God of Elohim. To see this, we need to study the chapters in Genesis, focusing on chapter 1. It requires understanding the immediate context, larger context, and the wider context of the Bible and the surrounding cultures of the day. Now I'm going to go through this next slide fast, focusing on the last one. You need to understand Akkadian literature like the Enuma Elish, which is called the Babylonian Genesis. That's just the context of the day. Hopefully you say agree, because that's what you do in other contexts. Where am I? Okay, the Enuma Elish, I must have pressed the wrong button, predates Genesis 1 by all accounts at about 1200 BCE. Both are products of the same Mesopotamian conceptual world, and they have similarities, like darkness precedes creation, same division of the waters, light exists before the creation of the sun, moon, and stars, and the sequence of the days of creation are the same. All right. When we take the Bible seriously, we discover a significant but unsuccessful cover-up about the gods we find in the Bible, who evolved over the centuries from polytheism to henotheism to monotheism. Polytheism is, you believe in a bunch of gods. Henotheism is you believe in the same bunch of gods, but you believe one's more powerful. And then monotheism, one God and one God alone. Genesis 1, 1 through 2, you've known it from your youth up. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was without form and void, and darkness covered the surface of the abyss, and the Spirit of God was moving over the waters. We're going to look at this. First, this is not describing the absolute beginning of time. We know this because the word "the" in verse 1, in the beginning, is not there. I like to quote from translators. Why does that keep doing that? I know it's my fault. I know it is. It has to be. Better translations. New Revised Standard Version says, when God began to create the heavens and the earth. That's a better translation. Or the New American Bible translation. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth. Those are better translations because of that. Second point, I'm going to give you 7. Second point, Genesis is not describing creation out of nothing. Instead, it's describing the making of something from pre-existing matter. We know this. Again, translation notes from the New English Translation. Genesis itself does not account for the original creation of matter. The heavenly sky did not exist prior to the second day of creation, and the earth dry land did not exist as we know it prior to the third day of creation. So we have to revise. Genesis 1, 1 through 2, God made the heavens and the earth, beginning with an earth. Okay, well, you can read the rest of it, but I'm going to go through it again. Genesis 1 begins ominously. What exists is a formless, empty earth hidden beneath a darkened, watery chaos. Third point, Genesis is not describing the creation of heaven, it's describing the origin of the skies above. It's not where you go when you die. It's not where the saints go when they die. It's just simply describing the skies as they knew them at the time. Third point, nor is it describing the origin of planet Earth, since it hadn't been discovered yet. It's describing the origin of dry land. They knew nothing else, you see. They saw nothing else. The dry land. To make a conversation meaningful, that's what they meant. 5, nor is it describing the spirit of God, it's describing the wind or breath of God moving over the waters. Now, of course, you can call it the breath of God if you think the wind is the breath of God, but since I don't think the wind or hurricanes or any kind of wind at all is breath of God, I prefer to call it wind like it should be called. So then we go back to our translation, and now we got God made the skies and the dry land beginning with land that was without form and void, and darkness covered the surface of the abyss, and the wind of God was moving over the waters. But we're not done. The two most important ones. The sixth one is, who was making the world in Genesis chapter 1? It was Elohim, a plural word for gods. I was consulting with Randall Heska, an Old Testament scholar, Hebrew, with a focus on Hebrew, and I asked him, he said, Elohim included the heavenly hosts. That is sons of God. Job 38:7, when the sons of God sang for joy, that's when Elohim created. Elohim says, let us make man in our image. Now, if you try to take the Bible seriously, you have to take the Bible seriously, not try to fit it into some Trinitarian hindsight type of apologetic, but just simply say, that's what it says. And then seventh, and we'll come back to that. The word abyss is misleading, since what is being described in Genesis 1 and 2 is not just a disordered mass of elements, it's a primordial chaos being manipulated and maintained by mischievous chaos gods. So let's go back to our translation. Elohim made the skies and the dry land, beginning with land that was without form and void, and darkness covered the surface of the chaos, and the wind of Elohim was moving over the waters. Let's go back. Who is Elohim? It's a Hebrew word which is derived from the name of the Canaanite god El, a shortened version of which is El Elyon, or God Most High. We find him in the Bible. He blessed Abraham in Genesis chapter 14. Then King Melchizedek of Salem brought out bread and wine, and he was a priest of El Elyon, and he blessed Abraham and said, blessed is Abraham by El Elyon, maker of heaven and earth, blesses him who has handed your enemies over to you, blah, blah, blah. He finds its way into the Bible, that God. El was the head of the Canaanite pantheon of gods, and there's his mugshot there. We found one of his idols, you see. El had a wife named Asherah, the queen of heaven. El had many sons of God with her, and these are legitimate deities all on their own. In Genesis 6, these embodied deities married women, had genitalia, and produced giants as offspring. You can read that for yourself right there in Genesis 6. That's crazy, right? That's odd. And then they were also in heaven watching the drama unfold in the book of Job. Now, we know that they worshiped El because their names, named for cities and places, Bethel, house of El, Peniel, face of El, Michael, who is like El, Daniel, judged by El, Israel, struggled with El, and Ishmael, heard by El. We can go on. We know they worshiped El. Now, Mark Smith is a really cool scholar. He's dug up a lot of archaeological data in the Iron Age, suggesting that the Israelite culture largely overlapped with and derived from Canaanite culture. In short, Israelite culture was largely Canaanite in nature. This is the world of the Bible that came out of. And even geographers, they know that. They note that. They put, that's the land of Canaan. It's not the land of Israel. Now let's go back one time more for chaos gods. Most ancient cultures believed there was someone or something causing chaos before the creative God came along to put a stop to their mischief. Chaos was usually personified as a god, the first god. They were typically associated with a wild, unpredictable, scary sea. This is fascinating, by the way. I don't know why this isn't working. Chaos gods were plentiful. Apophis, the Egyptian god of chaos. You had Eris, the Greek chaos goddess. You had Chaos. Imagine that. They named him Chaos, the Roman god of chaos. And then you had Tiamat, the Mesopotamian chaos god. Now, Tiamat was a chaos goddess of the saltwater ocean depicted in as a monster, a dragon, and the Enuma Elish Marduk, which was the chief god of the Babylonian pantheon, killed Tiamat and used her carcass to make the skies and dry land, or the heavens and the earth. This is from the Enuma Elish. Now for the kicker. In the Hebrew word in Genesis 1-2 for chaos is the Akkadian equivalent for Tiamat. I consulted with Dr. Hescott, and they said they're one and the same. So what's going on here? Elohim is fighting chaos gods in creation. Chaos gods like Rahab. Here's a verse from Job. By his power, and he churned up the sea. By his wisdom, he cut Rahab to pieces. Because that's what you have to do. You have to destroy the chaos god in order to do some creating. And then in Psalm, you crushed Rahab. With your strong arm, you founded the world and all that is in it. James Barr, biblical scholar of note, he said, this point of view, this way of seeing the matter, was almost certainly present to the minds of some biblical writers. Yeah, like Genesis 1, Psalms, Job, and Isaiah. Speaking of which, Isaiah 15, awake, awake, arm of Yahweh, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Then Yahweh responds, I am Yahweh, your God, who set the heavens in place, who laid the foundations of the earth, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar, and who say to Zion, you are my people. Acknowledging that he is actually doing the work that they claim him to do. Now, if you don't have a concept of an eternal God, this is the alternative. In a polytheistic world, gods are born from and return to chaos, just as people are born and die without them knowing our origins. In a polytheistic world, gods also fight each other, just like we do. Well, strange that, right? That's because human beings invent gods that resemble themselves given what we know about the world. And when our world changes, so also our gods change with the times. Now look at the 6 days of creation, called making now. Who is Elohim commanding? Have you ever stopped to think, let there be light? Who is he talking to? I always, from my youth up, thought, well, who is he talking to? Let there be waters, let there be the earth. Well, we now know, chaos gods. With each day, Elohim was freeing the skies and the land from the powers of their grips. Elohim lit the darkness from above, made dry land surface, and filled it with life. Let's go through these days. Let there be light. This wasn't a sunlight, which was to be made on day four. It was more like the dim light we see in a theater just before the show begins. Day two. Let there be a dome in the middle of the water in order to separate the water. And so Elohim took some of the waters, filled them up into the, lifted them up into the sky, held them in the sky with a gigantic metal dome, sorry, New American Bible translator note, supported by pillars. Later we find Elohim opening the floodgates in the dome of the sky to flood the earth in Genesis chapter 7. That's so much better to look at, you know. So that's what Elohim did. Then in the fourth day he said, let there be lights in the sky to separate the day and the night. And so he fixed the sun, moon, and stars and galaxies by the billions in the same dome that held back the waters from the land. Picture them like recessed lighting in a ceiling, something absurd given modern astronomy. Nothing what Scott said about science did this God know. We learn Elohim's throne is not far from the dome, not far above the dome in the sky, because he worried men might actually build a Tower of Babel up to him. You know the story. So God got upset. He said, oh, they could do that. So he confused them with their language and sent them down and dispersed them all over the earth. Because they actually thought they could go there, and so apparently did God. Jesus ascended up into the sky, from which we are told every eye will see him return. Well, that only makes sense because they believed heaven was literally up there and that the earth was flat. The earth is depicted as immovable, flat, and it uses the phrase the ends of the earth. A friend of mine did a lot of research on this called Ed Babinski, and his conclusion after doing his research. Taking the Bible at its word means thinking in terms of a flat earth. Now this is the revelation of the God in the Bible. In Elohim's world, the stars move. Ecclesiastes 1 says the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The stars also stopped. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky for about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since. Joshua, he asked the sun to stop for a battle. And the stars also point down. The star of Bethlehem pointed down to the for the Magi to know where the baby was born. Day five, Elohim made all aquatic and flying animals according to their kind without any understanding of how species originated via evolution, and plus he showed no awareness of dinosaurs. Now, so here's Elohim's universe. I mean, there's better pictures. I tried to get my focus on when I took that picture, but it didn't really work too well. Imagine that, a creator God who knows nothing about the universe. Elohim had a body. Day six, Elohim said, let us make man in our image and in our likeness. There's the God's problem, but also watch what happens in Genesis chapter 5. It repeats the same language in Genesis 5. It says, Elohim made man in his likeness. And then it says in verse 3 of that chapter, Adam had a son in his own likeness, and he named him Seth. So to the degree that Seth is the likeness of Adam, it's to the degree that Adam is the likeness of Elohim. And then on day 7, Elohim was tired, and he rested. There's only one reason why someone could be tired, is because they have a body. No spiritual being ever got tired. But we see this with Jacob, who struggled with a man one night. The man asked to be released, but Jacob refused until he blessed him. So Jacob was named Israel because he had struggled with Elohim and had overcome. Jacob called the place Peniel because I saw Elohim face to face, and yet my life was spared. So Elohim can struggle with you. You can actually win a struggle against Elohim, and you can see him face to face. Here's a book you can look at that, Francesca Savarocapolo. I can't tell you how many times I tried to pronounce that when I was practicing. I'm sorry, Francesca. Elohim doesn't exist. It's a Canaanite embodied deity invented by superstitious people. There's no excuse for a real creator to utterly fail basic science class, regardless of whether the days of creation were sequential or not. And there's no excuse for a real creator to mislead his creatures about something so important. I'm going to go through some of this. I don't know how much time I have.
5 minutes,
5 minutes left? All right. The God Yahweh doesn't exist. Dr. Garrickey says, the entity most readers refer to when they speak of God is an upgraded version of a Middle Eastern tribal deity called Yahweh. Yahweh, too, has a body. In the Garden of Eden, he was found heard walking in the cool of the day. And they hid themselves from Yahweh as if he had eyes. And if we just got behind this tree, he couldn't see us. And Yahweh says, I heard you. And in the garden, Adam and Eve said, I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. Yahweh let Moses see his body. Moses wanted to see Yahweh, so Yahweh said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, but you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Then Yahweh said, there is a place near me where you can be standing on a rock. I will put you on a cleft in a rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. This is an embodied God. Yahweh is an embodied God, just like Elohim, just like El. In the Old Testament, whenever you come across the phrase, the Lord our God, or the Lord God, or even Lord, Christian translators have hidden the truth behind those words. It's really Yahweh, or Yahweh your God. It's really significant. I'll tell you why. Because when it says, I am Yahweh your Elohim, well, who's the Elohim of someone else? When someone else is God, well, will you not possess what Chemosh, your Elohim, gives you? All that Yahweh, our Elohim, has given us, we will possess. So each God had a territory, and every territory had a God. We actually find the smoking gun. If you want to have a smoking gun, it's the Dead Sea Scrolls on Deuteronomy chapter 32:8-9. It says, when Elion divided the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he established the borders of the nations according to the sons of Elohim. Yahweh's portion was his people, Jacob, his allotted inheritance. Praise, O heavens, his people. Kneel before him, all you Elohim.
3 minutes, John.
3 minutes? Oh, okay. But I'm as relieved as they are. The New English translation note says the Masoretic Hebrew inserted sons of Israel. The Greek Septuagint inserted angels of God. But in the Dead Sea Scrolls, is considered undoubtedly the original reading. That means El, the chief God, gave Israel to Yahweh. In Psalm 82, you find God's ruling over people. Elohim presides in the divine council, and he renders judgment in the midst of the Elohim. That's God. He renders judgment in the midst of gods. How long are you going to judge unfairly? Defend weak people and orphans. Protect the rights of oppressed. These are gods that are misbehaving. And then this is the psalm continuing. I declare, Elohim, though you may be, you are all sons of Elion. Yet like Like any mortal, you shall die. Like any prince, you shall fall. So here's Elohim, here's Elohim presiding over gods, and finding that some of them are not doing their jobs, and they will die. See, chaos gods, all gods, polytheistic gods, they are born and they die. And here's the Canaanite pantheon of gods. I'll blow it up. There's Asherah and El. And then down below, there's Yahweh. Actually, he's a brother of Chemosh. There's some more. They're all in pantheons, same time period, same place as the Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, the people traveling back and forth. They knew these gods. Here's the Egyptian gods. They have a bunch of them about everything. They're all polytheistic. Here's the Greek gods. And notice on the Roman gods, they even have chaos really at the top there. They're all, this culture, this era of time, this people, these gods and goddesses, they sometimes take down different names from different cultures, but they are rule over the same sorts of things.
1 minute.
Okay, all right. Let's see. All right, imagine that a powerful God cannot defeat men in chariots. I like that. Yahweh was with Judah, and he drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. This is a God that somehow grew into being the omnipotent God that you worship. What could he do against tanks and fighter jets? And I'll just call it, what did you say, no more?
About 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Well, I go through and I talk about Yahweh then is a moral monster in the story of Job. And he didn't know that Job was a hypocrite. I mean, the accuser said, Job is a hypocrite, but if you test him, he will deny you to your face. Oh, really? I didn't know that. So he has him suffer. He kills off a lot of people and a lot of others. Destroy his property and give him boils from head to toe. And if God had known that Job would not curse him to his face, then he didn't need to cause him to suffer. Well, that's a ball for now. Thank you.
So we'll now proceed to the second part, which will be the rebuttals. It'll be 10 minutes for each participant. In the back, if you guys could put up the clock and set it for 10 minutes for each, and then just start it once they start speaking. Scott will go first.
Fellas, can we go slide 32, please? Thank you, John, by the way, for the entertaining presentation.
That was, I gotta do that, though.
Okay, I'm just going to cycle through it. Okay, these were the, by the way, the material that John just talked about, I find incredibly interesting and fascinating. There's a guy who writes on this topic named Dr. Michael Heiser, who writes, he's written a couple of books that I've read and a bunch that I haven't, but Supernatural, The Unseen Realm, and Reversing Hermann, that do a very good job, I think, of interpreting and talking about and pointing out the history and the archaeology and all that behind the stuff that John just talked about. Fascinating, interesting, and something I think every believer should dig deeply into. Not the topic of tonight's debate, though. Tonight's debate is, does God exist? And so I'll point out two things. One, here were the premises that I talked about. Now, in the rules of debate format, it's not John's job to interact with this material until the first rebuttal. So John is not supposed to have necessarily talked about these things. That's what he would do next. So although I know that there are some people in the debate that will say, well, he didn't talk about any of these things. Technically, that's not his job yet, and he has some more time to do so. But I'll say, at least in his opening statement, there was nothing in there that impeaches any of these premises. So if you're kind of doing an analysis of, have we heard good arguments for the existence of God, and have we heard good arguments against the existence of God, on the for the existence of God, as yet, we have not heard any reason not to believe that these are correct. Now let's talk about John's arguments. Maybe when we get to the conversation phase, I'll ask you to clarify a little bit, because I'd, I'm afraid that I've probably misinterpreted some of what you said, but I understood you to have made broadly four points. One, none of the arguments that we talked about here show which God of all the potential gods out there. And I disagree with that fairly strongly, and here's why. This is what these arguments gave us: a timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful designer of the universe who's conceivably a mind, and the designer of the universe, the greatest conceivable being, and the moral lawgiver. That is the God of monotheism. And monotheism, basically this God that these arguments produce, give you a true God Most High, one God who's the originator and creator of all these things. If that's the case, then you can narrow down a lot of the religions already, down to basically the monotheistic religions, because all these are arguments from scientific evidence and logic for a monotheistic God, which means you don't have to worry about most forms of Hinduism. You don't have to worry about Buddhism. You don't have to worry about Thor and Zeus and all that kind of stuff. You're basically down to what are really about a dozen monotheistic religions, but at least the most popular are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, a couple forms of Hinduism, a few others. So given that we have arguments that do produce a plausible and in some cases extremely probable and in some cases logically necessary God, we have to ask the question of what are these arguments supposed to show? Now, so I do think that if none of the arguments show which God, I just disagree with that. They very obviously point to a God of monotheism. Second, he says the God of the Bible does not exist, that Christians invent different conceptions of God to fit the arguments. Now, that is a very unusual position. I don't know that I've heard that before. I think it's fairly evident that in a polytheistic world, a concept of one God, of whom there is no greater, it was a fairly rare thing in ancient understanding of who gods are. So a lot of times, so Elohim is both a singular and a plural word for God and does in fact mean gods. And so I do agree with that, but I would point you to Dr. Hauser for how that can be interpreted in an alternate way, because it seems like the second point was I, John, and some other biblical scholars believe in a particular interpretation that says God was an evolution from a polytheistic God to a monotheistic God. There are an awful lot of other scholars who say very differently. So I don't think I understand the argument that says because I have one interpretation that claims the Bible comes from polytheistic roots, that therefore God does not exist. That doesn't follow logically. And if our standards are logic and evidence, which at least in his book, John goes to great lengths to say that logic, evidence, and especially scientific evidence are the kinds of things that we should be talking about, then I would question where the logic is. So this is just not a motivated argument at this point. Now, he does say God knew nothing about the universe. This is a nitpick, so throw this right out if you want. But he highlighted up there where it said that there were billions of galaxies. That wasn't known until this century. In fact, Einstein thought that in Einstein's day, they thought the universe was the size of our galaxy, 100,000 light years across. So if that were what it says, that's at least one piece of information that nobody knew until within the last 100 years. But I don't think that that's particularly compelling in light of all of it. I do have a little bit of a problem of the objection that says, hey, God was talking about the universe in such a way to pre-scientific people. I get this, I think, from atheistic perspectives a lot, which is why didn't God just explain how the universe really works? And I think if you're trying to talk to pre-scientific people, it would be odd to say, like, look, let me explain it simply. The Ricci curvature tensor and the metric tensor interact in a certain way that means that time, space, matter, and energy all work in a particular way that produces a closed, non-Euclidean surface. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? So I think that there's something to be said for, and heaven forbid that anybody from the future come try to tell us how things actually work, because we won't understand it either. You kind of need to talk to your kids the way that your kids understand things and pre-scientific people to the way pre-scientific people understand things. But I think even in that milieu, there's good reason for believing that biblical accounts are pretty good ones. That's bonus material. This is not the topic of tonight's debate. Tonight's debate is not, is the God of the Bible God? That is a worthy topic of debate, but that's not what I came here to talk about. It's not what we agreed to talk about. And at the end of the day, that's the second step. Step one is, does God exist? Once you figure out, yeah, God exists, okay, which God? Who's describing it correctly? It could be nobody. It could be multiple religions. But that's step two. We're not at step two. We're at step one. I guess I just briefly would say, I don't also don't understand the third argument, which seemed to be Yahweh does not exist because he has a body. Again, that doesn't follow logically in any way. I think it's entirely conceivable that the all-powerful creator of the universe, if he chooses to, could take a physical form. That seems entirely plausible to me. Again, an argument in an intellectual process, an intellectual logical process, should be plausible premises looking to establish a particular conclusion. And none of what John said, to my understanding of how you said it, amounts to an argument. So I'll probably yield the rest of the time back, but before I do, I'll point out none of this has been impeached yet, so you now have good reasons to believe that God exists. And right now, I don't believe that I've heard an argument in any form that I recognize with using valid logical rules of inference that say God does not exist. In fact, if I understood John correctly, he said it's possible God exists, he just thinks it's improbable, which is an unprecedented admission in an argument about does God exist. I think we need to ask of John that he bear his burden for this side of the argument, which is he needs to produce an argument that God does not exist. I'll yield the rest of the time, and we can use it in question time, I think.
John, you're up. And then please reset the clock.
Testing. Okay. Yeah, Scott, you're amazing.
Do you need this at all?
No, I don't either. No, I'm not going to. I'll go back to that. Delight to disagree with.
You too, sir.
You're so soft-spoken. Come on, yell, get excited. just a few things, you know, from your presentation. You talk about the universe and the Big Bang. But, you know, what accounts for the fact that the universe is accelerating? You can answer that. You know, we don't know. I don't think that we know. I mean, you have a Big Bang, you firecracker, boom, and it goes down. You know, gravity, you know, just takes care of that. The universe is accelerating. It leads people to posit that there might be other kinds of things out there beyond the universe that we don't know. There are other universes, for instance, and I don't know. The thing is, I'm willing to say I don't know. Why do I need to know something, you know, about something? The only people who can dispute the findings of science are other scientists working in that same field. Now, see, he's acting like a scientist. He's telling us about science. He's not a scientist. The only thing you can do is wait until science comes to a consensus that's different. You can't say, well, here, I got my scientist over here. He disagrees with all the others. You have to wait until there's a consensus of scientists on a particular issue. And when that consensus arises, then you can speak to the issue. Until then, unless you get the scientific degrees in the fields that you speak of, you really have no authority. All you have to do, and all we can do, us ignorant buffoons, if you will, is to simply quote what the science say. Here's what scientists say. Well, what do you think? Well, I can't say what I think. Here's what the consensus of science is about this or that. Make the idea that we need a personal creator, because without a personal decision maker, how could this have begun? It had to begun at a certain time and place. And so you have to posit a personal creator. But if the creator is timeless, okay, just grant him his hypothesis, if the creator is timeless, then at what time does he decide to make a universe that does not appear at that time? Well, there's no time for the creator to make that decision. So if it's an eternal decision, then that means the universe has always existed. And you really haven't got anything better than what we have now without a personal creator. Because if the personal creator made something in time, then the act to make that in time makes it happen now. So at no point in time can you go back in the infinite past to find the universe not having begun if we have a timeless God. And you just can't. Now, that's fine. Now, when it comes to the design and the astronomical odds, do you realize, people who use these arguments, they don't understand math. I mean, they simply don't understand math. And I'm not accusing Scott. If anybody knows math, he does. Okay? Maybe he doesn't, though. Any event in the past has an already astronomical odds against this event here. Let me just say it this way. The odds of you and I being here tonight, dressed as you are, with the haircut you had, and the comb over that you just put over, and the food in your stomach, and the shoes on your feet, and sitting where you are, not sitting there, sitting here, not sitting here, the odds of everyone here being in this room right now, listening to my very words as they come out of the mouth, is just absolutely astronomical given 10 years ago. And so if you were to calculate what are the odds of anything 20 years ago or 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, I mean, you would just blow your socks off. Well, that must mean that we're here because of God. That God is then the solution to a mystery that doesn't even exist. It's not a problem that we have astronomical odds on hindsight for every event that ever took place in the universe. So the idea that, oh, these odds are just astronomical, well, of course they are. It couldn't have happened any other way. In fact, if things had been just a little different, then we might have had a very slightly different universe by one hair or two hairs or by one person or by the color of a chair or whether or not we have grass in our yards, or weeds in our yards. Nothing but weeds. Oh, that'd be a beautiful sight, wouldn't it? Of a different kind of flower. With every change, we could have had a different universe. And they look at this and they say, well, look at this universe. It's astronomically bizarre that we should exist with grass as it is, or the trees as they are, and so therefore God. Well, no, we could have had a different universe. I mean, with the odds, that we know about how they work. And I don't know how they work. And I'm not going to propose I know how it worked. But I know that when you substitute one mystery for another mystery to answer a mystery, you've added nothing to our basis of knowledge. The mystery is how we got here. And if you say, well, God did, that's adding a mystery to a mystery. You haven't solved anything. You haven't created anything new in trying to discover how you are here. Now, he talks about suffering, too, and I did write a book on horrendous suffering. It's a dandy, if I don't say so myself. My book is on horrendous suffering. It's called God and Horrendous Suffering. See, I'm not talking about God keeping us from a paper cut on our fingers when we glance across a paper. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking those kinds of things. Let us have it. Add it, you know, a flat tire, you know, that doesn't hurt or kill anybody. That's fine. These are kinds of things that could happen in a universe where we have flesh and blood. Question, of course, is why he needed any flesh and blood creatures in the first place. That's a different area. But with God, horrendous suffering is the problem. It's getting like walking down a road and some stray arrow hitting your neighbor in the eye, just bouncing it out, you know. Why did that have to happen? That person had plenty of things in this life to test her soul without that too, you know. What about the child burning in a building, you know, set ablaze by some accident? Those kinds of things don't need to have happened. I have plenty of suggestions on how they could, how some of this horrendous suffering could be alleviated if God had created us all with one color of skin. If we were all one color of skin, there'd be a lot of, create us all purple if you want, I don't care, or red. If we were all colored the same color, there'd be a whole lot less racial divisions and wars in this world. But no, God didn't think of that, or he couldn't. Maybe he could have created us all with terminal velocity of zero so that when you jumped off a building, you float down because your body weight isn't heavy enough to hurt you if you fall. Like for instance, an ant. An ant you could drop here or a mile high is still going to land on its feet because it doesn't have terminal velocity. It doesn't have the weight required to kill itself when it hits the ground. Maybe God could have given us a bigger threshold of pain, you know? you know, ouch, what happened? Well, I got a splinter in my thumb, you know. Oh, come on, give me a break. But if the threshold were higher, we could suffer more and not actually suffer more. Why can't our arms grow back? You know, they've got the starfish arms, they grow back. You know, they grow back. It's in nature. God, apparently, if he created them, then he already knows how to do that. Why can't he do it with us? And it would be so natural that we wouldn't know any different. We'll wait till Bernie's hand grows back, then we'll be okay. We'll go out and play some more tennis. But apologists, they lack an imagination. What they have is their God, and everything has to fit in that grid. They won't entertain the idea that God could have done something different or the universe could have ended up different. They just simply lack the imagination because their minds are controlled by the beliefs that they were taught as kids. About the same time you teach them about Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, you know, and they've got to just defend that at all costs rather than think, well, how could things be different? What if rather than destroy a people because they were sinners, why not just make the wombs of the mothers barren for a generation? Just all of a sudden, boom, strike them with barrenness. Right? There'd be no pain in that. They just couldn't give birth. There'd be some kind of pain, I guess, involved in that. But you wouldn't have to, if in the Bible, destroy all the Amalekites, destroy all the Canaanites, or whatever. Why couldn't God just set up in years in advance and say, okay, from now on, no more Canaanite babies? they lack this imagination that I try to bring back as much as I can. And I've got more jokes and other things if you give me time. I'm at least good for that. I think that's why they bring me back. I don't know. Maybe he'll make a fool of himself again. I don't know. He's supposed to be a scholar. He sure doesn't sound like one.
That's great. Although I love all of this, probably this next section may be my favorite. It's going to be a facilitated conversation between our two participants tonight. Scott, did we say you're going to ask the first question or get asked the first question?
I think we said, but either way is fine with me.
John, do you have a preference?
No.
No? Okay. No. How about you ask the first question and Scott responds and we'll go back and forth? Is that good?
You're the moderator.
And try and, as best you can, keep up to about 1 to 2 minutes so we have enough back and forth. Cool. Okay. And go ahead and start once the first question's asked.
Okay, Scott. So you're all for free will, I assume. First off, I think there's a lot of arguments to show that we don't have as much free will as you need for your God to judge us. Well, I'll set that aside. What if there's someone so bad, so horrendous, so heinous of a character who can destroy the earth in just a push a button? Why would God allow that? Let's just start there. That's a big one. Why would God ever think that free will is a good thing to have rather than simply taking him by the scruff of the neck and throwing him in prison?
I think I'm not 100% sure about one person who can destroy the whole world. I don't assume you're talking about anybody.
All right. Well, how about the molestation and killing of a child. Okay.
Yes.
And you had it. That's more. Yeah. And what's so good about free will than for like if a sheriff were in town, he'd take a look at that and he'd say, "Come here with me, Buster," and shackle him and take him off to prison. But no, God thinks free will of that nature, the horrendous kind of nature, that is that so good and so worthwhile that I'm going to go ahead and let him eat popcorn while it happens. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know that God eats popcorn while he watches that kind of stuff happen.
Well, I would hope not if he exists, right?
I imagine if he's all good and all loving that he's grieved by when people do stuff like that. But I also think that you have to ask the question of how much evil are we going to allow to happen? So when we made our pretend world in here of just the people in this room, the question is, how much do you allow to happen? So John has said in the past, like, what if God made all bats out of marshmallows? So if you swung and hit somebody, it wouldn't really hurt that bad. The idea, and C.S. Lewis deals with this, some of you probably read it, of where do we limit evil? What is the maximum amount that can be allowed to happen and still be compatible with both free will and a loving world? I think one of the assumptions, John, it seems that you operate on, so forgive me for projecting.
You're probably right.
Is that the purpose of this world right here is for everybody to live in peace and harmony and happiness. And I'm saying that if we put significant thought into how do we get a world that is both all loving, all volunteer based on free will, and is long-term sustainable, that you have to have a rescue phase where evil is anywhere from present to rampant. So the answer to your question of what does that stuff serve to do is it serves to help a lot of us, people in this section, to look at that evil and be like, good gracious, that is awful. That makes my stomach turn. I know I need to not be doing that. What else do I not need to be doing? And over time, learn to choose the good. If you'll give me another 30 seconds, I'll give you what I think is the worst edge case in modern history, which is the Holocaust. Like, how can the Holocaust be good? How is there any good to the Holocaust? Or how is there? Why didn't God stop that from happening? I would say, like, the Holocaust is arguably maybe the worst modern travesty we've seen. But if what you're trying to do, you know, God's not treating us like toddlers. God's treating us like teenagers and adults. And in the same way that, yeah, you would be culpable if you gave a two-year-old, as you say, a razor blade. You'd be responsible for what happens to that two-year-old. You're not culpable when you give your 24-year-old a razor blade. And in fact, if every time your 24-year-old was about to make a bad decision, you jumped out of the back of their car and said, stop what you're doing the wrong thing, at some point they might come to resent that and want a little bit more freedom of their own. So consider the Holocaust as an example. 6 million Jews dead for a horrible reason. Prior to that, in fact, I'll give him my question time so that I can answer his question, if that's okay with you. If prior to that time in Western Europe, anti-Semitism was rampant. Like we had pogroms. Jews had been kicked out of England for 300 years. Like treating Jews bad was entirely cool at the time. Right up until then, America was leading the eugenics movement. We had sterilized more people than anybody in the world, and tens of thousands of people involuntarily. We had Carnegie Institute was tracking people's bloodlines in the hopes of eventually extinguishing them. Dr. Mengele, the evil angel of Auschwitz, angel of death of Auschwitz, they call him. I probably shouldn't call him the angel of death. But he was actually worked initially on a program sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation. America, Hitler's several times cited American leadership in eugenics. When we went to war with the Nazis, the 40 million or so of civilians and military that died and didn't do that in order to stop killing, didn't do that in order to stop genocide. We didn't know about that at the time. We did that to stop an expansionist Nazi Germany. In my opinion, those 6 million Jews that died, they were the heroes that stopped eugenics in its tracks. What would America have been if we slowly worked our way into what Germany quickly became? One of the reasons America turned away from eugenics was what we saw what happened when the Germans ramped it up that quickly in Nazi Germany. And so, as horrible as it is, those 6 million deaths stopped 350 million people from going down a potentially equal or worse path. Now, you might say, well, good gracious, could he have done it less than 6 million? Still okay to be anti-Semitic in many places. Eugenics is still going on. So it actually wasn't enough to stop it for everybody. Thank you for your patience, John. In fact, I'll give him my question time so that, because I used way too much to answer your question. But that's the shortest I could answer your question. Or I'll ask a question if you want to gather your thoughts either way. Yeah.
Well, I just... To the person in Auschwitz who is dying from malnutrition and just that, it doesn't do him any good to know that he's going to be a good lesson for the rest of the world for 10 years or 15 years. Like, oh, gee, do I get to be used for that? I don't think lessons learned on hindsight can ever do anything to the individuals, comfort the individuals who are suffering. You want to comment on that? I mean, why?
Yeah, I agree. I didn't mean that as a statement to say, and that should be an adequate answer to somebody who died in the Holocaust. The point, though, is if something like Christianity is true, and this is the first phase, their death there is not the end. So the question is, did they live their life in a way that gives whoever this, in our case, we were playing the role of God, gives us the reason, the belief to say this person is somebody that we would keep in heaven. So whether they lived a natural life to 100 years old and died, or whether they were killed murderously and torturously beforehand, if the answer is they live an eternity of happiness in a perfect place, then that would presumably be the recompense for having to go through the receiving of evil. Now, presumably, we don't want to be on the receiving end of evil, but it depends on what the purpose of this world is. And so a different way I would answer that question is, would you, and I asked this of my brother one time, would you be willing to go through what you're going through now if it meant that your daughter or your son would go from doing the wrong thing to the right thing? And he was like, I'd go through anything for that. And if we truly loved each other the same, then if we were being honest, we would say, I would be willing to be one of the Holocaust victims. If you're a Christian, you should be willing to say this. John doesn't have to say this, but if you're a Christian, you should be willing to say, but because you don't.
It might depend on who it is.
Yeah, well, maybe so. But to the Christian, it shouldn't depend on who it is.
I have a list of enemies.
To the Christian, it shouldn't depend on who it is, because you're supposed to love your enemies as much as your friends. But to the Christian, we should be willing to say, I would have been a victim of the Holocaust if it meant one more person would see this as a warning and turn from the evil to the good. Sure,
I'd like to answer the origin of life argument.
Yeah, fire away.
I don't know. Yep. I mean, what if you go back in time and someone would say, look at the constellations of the stars, the planets, why are they moving erratically? They have a backward retrograde action. And somebody were to say, I don't know. But why is that not an adequate answer? Why do you have to have an answer to how life originated? And I want to go to one fact.
Go ahead.
Well, we have discovered, and we don't have to debate this, but let's just assume as factual that we evolved, okay? We know that once there's life, it evolves, whether macro or micro. I just want to draw you in to agree with something there.
Okay.
So, not knowing what you think about it, but evolution works once there's life. But do you? How hard was that discovery? I mean, Darwin, you had to do all kinds of experiments and observations and draw some conclusions, and you had to buck some trends of people who disagreed with you, and we're still fighting that somewhat, Yeah. If we were able to discover how evolution works, given time, and science is really short-lived so far, 300 years, I guess, no modern science. So why can't we give time to science to help us with the origins of life as well?
Absolutely can we do that. I think what we can't do, it's perfectly fine to say, I don't know. But that's being an agnostic about it. And it's fine to be an agnostic. But it's not fine to be an agnostic to get up on a stage and argue that there is no God. Those are incompatible. So if you're going to say, I'm an atheist, and I'm going to get on stage and argue there is no God, then you have some implied responsibility to make an argument for that. So I'm perfectly fine with you saying, I don't know. In fact, I think it's intellectually honest to say so. What I don't think is okay, though, is to say, I don't know, therefore God doesn't exist.
Well, I'm not doing that.
But here we are. Look at the topic behind you. It's, does God exist?
No. What we do know, what science has shown us, is that evolution, works. I mean, we've discovered something amazing. It's one of the greatest discoveries ever. That's what many scientists say. What's the greatest discovery? Evolution, but Darwin's theory. So we know that, right? So that's what we know, what science can produce. And since science did an amazing job of that, well, let's just give them time on the origins of life, too. I do know something, evolution. I'm applying it to an unknown mystery that we don't know yet.
Yeah, if what you're saying is we have to be, we have to wait until science knows for certain, what is it that you think science knows for certain right now?
What?
What do you think science knows for certain right now? To such a point that we can't debate
A bunch of things. There's this New York Desk Science Reference book I've got a copy of it. It's, you know, if I could sit right here vertical and it wouldn't fall over. It's big, you know. It's a green color, and you thumb through it, and categories like scientific notations, you know, planetary, you know, developments.
Can you give me one example of a scientific fact that you think is established beyond debate?
Well, that the Earth is sliding along the skin. The outer parts of the Earth is sliding on the Earth as a molten fact, and that's what causes earthquakes, and that's why we have a continental drift. We know this. Okay. We have about 25 miles of dirt and, you know, stuff, and it just switches back and forth.
Okay. So what percentage of science do facts like that? Let's say that's a fact that we know for as certain as we're going to know anything. What percentage of the facts that science teaches are ones that we know to that degree of certainty?
What does science teach that I don't know for certain?
What does science teach? Well, I guess what I'm asking is, well, I don't know. There are facts that we know for certain in science, and there are facts that seem to change over time. And by change over time, what I mean is, if you picked up a textbook from 100 years ago and you compared it, a scientific textbook from 100 years ago, and you compared it to now, they're not the same.
There's a whole lot less to be changed nowadays. I mean, at first, scientists were grappling. You know, they were grappling around. Some people spent a whole lifetime hoping to get a certain result and never got it. They had to give up the theory, you know. But there's a lot less of that as scientists in all the different areas around the globe, and more people get into science. They come up with sound conclusions based on their research. And
okay,
there's
so
a whole lot
those,
less.
I'm sorry, I didn't
changing
mean
your mind.
So of those kinds of truths that we build a consensus on, that we say, okay, we've got a consensus of science. Once we have a consensus on it, is it something that we ought to trust? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, you can't.
So there's a consensus that the universe began to exist. Do you, because there's a consensus, are you now saying that you affirm that the universe began to exist?
If there's a consensus that's from people who use science properly,
yes,
then like, you can't doubt it. A consensus from scientists who use science, because there are people who don't.
Sure, but let's say a bunch of cosmologists call it the standard model because there's such a consensus on it that they literally call it standard. Is that what you think is makes something scientifically dependable?
Well, if it's a consensus of scientists, that's the highest authority. They could be wrong,
okay,
and maybe it could be overturned, but unless you're a scientist, you can't really dispute what they have to say. But that doesn't mean you have to draw the conclusions they draw or others draw from that either.
Right. No, you would need a deductive argument in order to draw conclusions from it. Agreed. Okay. I'm good with that question.
Okay, so, you know, you asked about Yahweh and Elohim. I didn't get to, you know, the God we find in the New Testament, Jesus, or the God of the philosophers. That's my own fault, I know. You say, well, make an argument. Make an argument, you know. I'm trying to share why the Bible is like it is, and if it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. Now, that's what my argument. Now, here's the thing. Here's how it works.
Can you lay it out for me? I'm a little bit slow when it comes to arguments. Like I only know how to put them in like premises and conclusion kind of form. If you had to make an argument that God didn't exist, what would it look like?
Well, embodied polytheistic gods from ancient pre-scientific people are most probably false.
All right, I'm happy to stipulate that. I agree with that.
And then Yahweh, okay. Yahweh and Elohim are such entities, you know, and so therefore it's probably false. Now, I'm not saying that this makes it impossible to be true, just that it's probably false.
I missed the argument, though. Can you formulate it again for me in an argument form?
Looks like a duck. Quacks like a duck.
It is. Must be a duck.
It looks like it's evolving gods and goddesses having sex with each other, producing children from women, I mean, human mothers.
Yep, yep.
And this is such a bizarre... Look, why would you believe anything found in that book if they had such incredibly bizarre things like that in it? It's like the Virgin Mary tells Joseph, I'm pregnant with child. Does Joseph go walk away? Oh, well, gee, yeah. He did that. He went and he slept on it. And in Matthew chapter 1, it says three times that Joseph had a dream. He was convinced Mary was telling the truth that God made her pregnant in a dream. A dream convinced him. And I say the same thing about the New Testament, the Gospels. Why would you believe anything in the New Testament once Matthew included that in his story? Once he did that, say, Joseph was convinced because of a dream. Why would I believe anything else in that? So I'm saying to you, why would I believe anything if those kind of deeds and those kind of gods existed in the Bible? They treated me like that. That's what I'm saying.
I'm happy to talk about this, and we'll stay off topic. But if we can, treat that in the best possible way, which is, okay, look, Scott, despite the fact that you're arguing for the philosopher's God, you personally believe in the God of the Bible. You're right about that. Okay, so if what you're saying is, I don't want to have the debate about does God exist, I want to talk about whether the God of the Bible exists, then what we would have to do is have a reasoned intellectual discussion, including all the evidence, especially historical evidence, and honestly, interpretive evidence in terms of like what do the languages here mean, because you presented an interpretation, but I think conservatively I would call that a edge interpretation. That is not the consensus of most. That is not the consensus of most biblical scholars. It's not even the consensus of many liberal scholars either. But let's say that we want to put that interpretation out there as a possibility. We need to have that discussion in a realistic, intellectually honest fashion, so we can do that.
Fair enough.
The problem is that's not the topic tonight. Later we want to do a debate on that, I'm happy to do so. But this is the topic for tonight, which is why the material I've prepared has been towards this topic,
yeah,
not towards this one.
I felt bad about preparing this. I wanted to tell you that what I was going to deal with so bad, but I didn't want to.
Next time you can feel free
because,
to do so.
Because for me, if you followed up in my writings, I have a low degree of the philosophy of religion, even though I have master's degrees in that discipline, because I've seen how philosophers of religion deal with the Bible and deal with theology and deal with God. And they are, generally speaking, they twist and turn and obfuscate and they hide and they try to pull the wool over people's eyes. And so I want to go back to where it all begins, and it begins with the Bible.
And I am aware of all your background, which is why I know you've got the logical training to do so. So I still would love, if you're able to do it, I know it's asking to do something on the fly is hard, and you don't have to, but if you can, generate an argument for why God doesn't exist. It walks like a duck. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and must be a duck, isn't actually logically valid. The conclusion does not follow from the premises. What you would do is say, it's very probably a duck. But my little daughter, who's 4 years old, does an amazing job of walking like a duck and quacking like a duck. And I don't conclude that she's a duck.
If I might say, it doesn't follow with certainty. If that's what you're saying, it doesn't follow.
My daughter is very grateful for that. Yes.
It doesn't follow.
I think that's a perfect segue. So the next section will be the closing arguments. Each participant will have 7 minutes. So perfect, got the clock set. Once they start, you can start the clock. And then after that, we'll do the Q&A. But please wait till the closing arguments are finished before coming forward for the Q&A. Scott will go first.
Okay, if we can put 32 back up, that would be great. I'll probably just make one comment once the slide comes up, but in the meantime, I'll answer all the questions that I can in this time that John brought up in his rebuttal. So what's the cause of the accelerated expansion of the universe? I think the consensus today among cosmologists is that it is either kind of lambda, it's Einstein's cosmological constant, and it is present in something like dark energy. So that's the lead hypothesis at this point. Again, we don't know. You did say you have to be, it seems to me that you said you have to be a scientist to understand scientific evidence. And you said I wasn't a scientist. Some of the work that I do for Department of Defense implies strongly that I would be a scientist. But if your point is that you don't, unless you're an expert in the field, you can't understand the evidence in the field, I don't think that's correct. If that were the case, we would only ever think one very narrow thing. And yet you hold all kinds of opinions about subjects in which you're not expert, including what you're not a nutritionist, but you seem perfectly fine to select what you want for breakfast. So I don't think it's necessary that you have to be an expert in order to understand something about the evidence. I think you said you need to wait on a consensus in science before you use it. That's fine with me. These premises represent the consensus of science, so let's use them. And I agree with your standard, and when you use your standard, it gives you a theistic philosopher's god, a monotheistic god. I think you asked why it could be a personal creator. This work? Okay. I think this is the answer to your question. So first, I would get rid of a notion that a lot of people have that God, prior to creation, is sitting around being like, what am I going to do today? Not a lot going on today. Today, does day even make a sense yet? I haven't done day yet. We'll do day later. What am I going to do now? So time has a particular property, and the time can only ever be a interval. Time is not a point. So you can have what we would call a point in time, but it only exists across an interval. So there can be an edge to one end or another. Time can begin and time can end, but time proceeds across an interval, usually in a continuum fashion is the way of which we conceive it. So what you see here is actually comes from my paper on the Trinity that I presented at the National Conference for this kind of stuff in San Antonio years ago. And I don't think this is going to work, is it? You can't see that. Okay. So if you see the W sub N, it represents a necessary world. That is, the world as God is was before he's created anything. So this is God in his timeless state, which is kind of an orthodox Christian philosophical view. So in this timeless state, it's also, to my mind, John points out rightly, that would be, if anything, the possible first moment in time. So William Lane Craig's view, as an example, is God sitting there timelessly, and then when he creates something, because, as John points out, creating something is an action and requires an interval, Craig thinks that God steps into time as a result. So prior to creation, Craig says that sans creation, God is atemporal, and then with creation becomes temporal because he enters into time. I have a different view, which says the Father, one person of the Trinity, timelessness is an essential property. Essential properties cannot be abandoned. But that an omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient God would, in the case of the creation of a temporal world, also enter into that temporal world. And this is what I think actually motivates at least two people of what is called a Trinity. So if God had not created anything, he would only be one. But given that God creates a world, one person of the Trinity enters into time. This is not an orthodox view. So if you don't like this view, Craig's view is one that says, yeah, that's right. God, there was nothing prior because God had not done anything, and there was no interval because God wasn't thinking. When he makes a decision, going from, so to speak, now I think you could argue, and I do this on the previous slide, that the set on the left are the set of all possible worlds, and the tracks there are the necessary world down to possible world 1, possible world 1.1, possible world 1, possible 1.2. These are different ways the actual world could be. That God, being omniscient, knows what each of those would look like, and also, because he knows all true propositions, would know which world he intends to create. So he doesn't actually have to think about it. This is something that he already knows in virtue of being omniscient. In fact, it's necessary that he knows that. And so that red world, the actual world, Alpha, just is one which possible world God actualizes, which means it's part of the set of knowledge that he would have atemporally to start with. So hopefully that answers your question, John. So any event has an astronomical odd against it, by that argument, John, no event is probable. And if you believe that no event is probable, then this has been an entertaining time. I would like to propose a trip to either Atlantic City or Las Vegas. And you fund it, I'll work on it. Okay.
Inconceivable.
Yes. Perfect. You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means. If no event is, that's just not how probability works. It's not the case that no event is probable. And it's not the case that no event is improbable. That's just, in my opinion, a simple misunderstanding of how it works. What it becomes improbable is specific specified events among a group of possibilities. And this is standard in physics and cosmology. In fact, in Hawking's view, it's Feynman's infinite integral path where the path of least action is the most probable, and the other paths, especially the most divergent paths, are the least probable. So at least in cosmology and physics, there's a most probable world track, and there's a number, perhaps an infinite number, of least probable world tracks. But the view that no event is probable is just not how probability works. And you seem to also imply that small changes in the kind of fine-tuning stuff are only slightly different universes would result. That this is hard. This is not easy to understand, but that's not what the fine-tuning argument about physical constants and quantities are talking about. The small changes and in even slightly larger changes don't mean that the universe would have slightly different, you know, serial here or there. It means that the universe wouldn't have even formed in the first place. You wouldn't even get matter in the first place. You wouldn't be able to form anything past hydrogen or helium or lithium in the first place. These people have likened it, atheists have likened it to an ocean 1,000 miles deep, 1,000 miles wide of possibility, with an oil sheen the size of a leaf on the top of it that represents the combinations of constants and quantities that give you a universe that has matter in it at all. So that's a little bit of a misunderstanding. I'm out of time. So if I can make one last comment then on horrendous suffering, don't forget that the horrendous suffering has to do with the purpose of the world. The purpose of the world right now is not everybody lives their best life. The purpose of the world is determining who can you let into heaven that won't turn around and wreck it. So thank you for your willingness to give me a couple of seconds there.
Thank you. Yeah, when I'm talking about science and us being able to dispute science, I'm talking about the consensus of sciences. And, you know, it's the only way that science can be overthrown is by more science. Not by faith, not by the Bible, more scientists who examine the data and come away with a different conclusion, and the highest authority is the consensus of sciences. It always has been, even though they've been wrong in the past numerous times. You know, scientists have come to different theories about ether that are ludicrous and other sorts of stuff, but we don't have any higher authority. I mean, you can't quote the Bible. I mean, really, you can't do that. That has no answers. It never really gave us a good answer. The only answer the Bible apparently gives is creation, but we've looked at that from Genesis 1. We saw that the Creator doesn't know anything about the universe. And I think it's a telling duck quack if I've ever seen one and heard one. So, and I still want to know what is the problem with Creator God not making us all one color of skin. Purple, I don't care, yellow, you know, green, white, black. It doesn't matter. Make us all the same color, and we'll have a lot less violence against racial groups. Hell, sorry.
That's okay.
There are asexual creatures that he supposedly made. They can produce offspring by themselves. Asexual. They're not male or female. He could have made us. If he did it once in creation, he could make us all. Then we wouldn't have any male-female fighting. You know, I don't know. There'd be other sorts of consequences. But there's a lot of things that God could do, but he didn't do. And I don't see how the God that you come up with is a God that is worshipful. You know, I mean, it's not something that you worship. I mean, it might be something to be studied, you know, and I think that there are scientific experiments on prayer that could be studied out to find out whether or not prayer answers anything better than chance, which they've already discovered that prayer doesn't answer anything better than chance alone. It is at such a small degree of difference that it's no difference at all. And when it comes to those constants, you said if they were changed by just a little bit, you wouldn't have a universe at all, it's that. Well, then make them smaller. I mean, why do you have only a certain limitation of what smallness is? If they were changed by just even a small little piece of data, then all of a sudden we wouldn't have a universe. Well, then what about a smaller piece? Well, where's your measurements coming from? Why are you once again lacking such an imagination for what could have been if the constants were different? I mean, not
the size of increments that they measure it by that comes up with the result. So I still think that these arguments, they don't lead to his God. I don't think they work. I think the argument from design utterly fails when you consider the argument from horrendous suffering. I mean, if it's designed so well, then how come our bodies wear out long before we're ready to die because we live longer now because of science? We live longer, so therefore the spine gives you a problem, whereas because we used to crawl on all fours, you know, not us necessarily, but somewhere back in our ancestors. And so that's why our spine begins to hurt at about, I don't know how old about you, but 45, 50, maybe even earlier. Depends on your spine problems. So God could have given us a better spine, you know, if he had made us initially as human beings rather than apparently up through chimpanzees and what have you. So I don't see anything that would change my mind. There might be some possible remote God out there. But if it's going to be discovered, it's not going to be discovered by some ancient goat herders in the distant land of Palestine who knew nothing about these sorts of things and saw visions and ghosts and talked about miracles that happened left and right, which have no objective evidence for them at all. He would have given them good scientific information, or science themselves would find it. And once science finds something like this, it's no longer... It all of a sudden it evacuates the faith out of it, because if you can explain something like how the Bethlehem star pointed down to Magi to where the baby Jesus was, then you found the star and you can explain it, and you say, well, here's what astronomy tells us about it, and so this is what happened scientifically. There's no more miracle, because once you explain it, there's no more miracle, because a miracle is something that's supposed to be mysterious, and if you can, you know, and without that element to it, there's no miracle. So in every way, in every shape, I remain adamant, militant. That's the wrong word, because that speaks of guns. I mean that. I don't see any reason to believe in the God of the Bible. And the only reason you're going to believe in any other God is because you believe in the God of the Bible. That's where the crux lands, and that's why I decided to, you know, deal with the God of the Bible. But I didn't finish. It's okay. Read my books and find out for yourself if you want. I wish Scott well in this church. It's been magnanimous hosts, beautiful in every way. I look forward to coming back for that second debate. And I'll try to meet him on his terms, or maybe he can come and meet me on my terms. I welcome that, you know, if that happens. But that's all I've got to say. Thank you.
In the very last part, we'll do the question and answer. If you have a question for Mr. Loftus, please line up on this side here in front of this microphone. And if you have a question for Mr. Tomlinson, please line up on this side. We'll start with Mr. Loftus. So if you'd like to come up, please go ahead. One quick thing, try and keep as best you can to a minute or two so we get a couple questions in.
Hi. Thanks for coming. You referenced the Genesis 6, where the fallen angels mated with the daughters of men and created the Nephilim, or the Geber, created men of renown, the giants like David and Goliath. Would you agree that scientists and archaeologists have found evidence pointing to giants?
Scientists have what?
I asked, would you agree that there has been evidence found by scientists or archaeologists pointing that there are giants?
Well, there are, let's see, Herodotus wrote about Amazon women, and they found that they found some graves of these Amazon warriors, you know, that's what they were, so yeah. But these were unusual giants. These were sired by gods, you see, and... picture this, a male god comes down upon a female, you know? That's what was going on. It's just, it's so bizarre that to find evidence for such a thing, it would be, show me the evidence. Just show me the evidence.
Okay. We're actually going to go over here to one for Scott first. Go
All right. A quick question to both, but Scott, you said that you lacked imagination. So just quickly, can you imagine a square circle?
I think you cannot imagine a square circle because it's, as he said earlier, inconceivable, which is, while funny in the context of the movie, is actually one of the ways that we go about. There are some people who believe that you cannot come to conclusions sitting in your armchair philosophically. I think that that's false, and this is an example of things that you can conclude. So there are a number of things that are incredibly valuable to know that you can simply get to by philosophy, which is one of the reasons I highlight the ontological argument in the same way that René Descartes can go from je pense donc je suis to some sort of, you know, it obviously comes to a conclusion. There were other premises before that. So too can we sit there and literally understand that a God exists, even if we were paralyzed, blind, deaf, and dumb, which is, I think, pretty cool.
John, you want to answer that as well? Or? He said it was for both of you.
Well...
John's like, what was the question?
I don't understand why, when you talk about lack of imagination, all of a sudden you talk about square circles. I'm talking about something so simple as everybody be made of one color skin, you know, or terminal velocity when you drop, you don't kill yourself. Yeah, that's the kind of imagination that they lack, I think.
Well, what I would say is if you think that fixing the skin color would fix everything, I'll send you a book I have on the history of war in Europe that puts into question.
I never said it would fix everything.
I'm just poking you, John. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you. In an interview with Mr. Frank Ziedler, you mentioned that when you were a believer, it was your first love, and you lost your first love. So my question to you is, do you miss him? Do you miss your first love as a former believer? If you find yourself...
Do I miss God? Do I miss...
Yes.
Well,
please.
I like Christmas music. Come Christmas... I like to play a lot of Christmas music because it brings back memories. You know, I like Christmas music, and it's Christian. But do I miss? There's certain things about it. Yeah, I mean, if you were to be carted off to Australia, and ask whether or not you miss back home, you would miss back home. I mean, you were raised that way. You know, you have family and friends who look down on you because you no longer believe, or you know, other things, and so that. Kind of thing, yeah, I miss that. And it's always nice to have a pie in the sky. But it doesn't exist, so I grow up. I take one foot in front of the other, and I do whatever I can, the best I can, and it's better than trusting in the stars or a prayer. So.
Okay.
Hi, Scott. John made a comment about the probability that, you know, that everyone is... whatever all their names are, that they would be sitting in the actual seats that they're sitting in, that probability from 5 years ago is like astronomically low. So I know there's something wrong with that argument, but I can't figure out what it is. Could you help me figure out what that is?
You bet. Yeah, you bet. Yeah, so it depends on the quiz. Probability, we only make probabilistic assessments, either in science or in life, when we don't know. So deterministic events don't require probabilities. Deterministic events are things that we know will happen for certain. So right now, for the way that we do things, the roll of the dice is probabilistic because we don't tend to track die in such a way that when you roll them, you know what's going to happen. But that's actually a deterministic process in the scales that this happens in physics. So as it turns out, when we have the computer systems that can do this and the scanning systems that can do this and the physics that can do this down to the particular level... the roll of the die will be able to predict when it comes off of the hand at this angle with this rotational angular momentum. It will be a six. Alternately, when cards are down on a table, we say, okay, someone put one card down on the table. The probability face down from a regular deck, the probability that that's an ace of spades is 1 in 52. That doesn't actually affect the fact of what the card is. So it's actually a deterministic event. The probability simply indicates our ignorance of what the event is. And we say of all the possibilities that are there, we know of 52 of them, so it's one of those 52. So probability represents an epistemological position, and a position of partial ignorance. So if you were going to say, what's the probability that this person was going to sit in that seat wearing these clothes? That's one probability. If you're going to say, given that a event was going to be held here tonight, what's the probability that a person would be sitting there? Now, what's the probability that a person would be sitting there who's a specific person picked out of Northern Virginia? All of these are probabilities that are different. And this is why Bayesian probability matters. All probability, as it turns out, is actually expressed in terms of, given the prior probability, what's the probability of this event? And that's the answer to the question. So this is a little bit of a misunderstanding, in my opinion, of what probability is. And it's the particular specified event. So maybe a little easier to comprehend would be lottery numbers. So what's the probability that I'm going to pick a lottery number and it's going to be right? It's one in several hundred million. What's the probability that someone's going to win the lottery? That's a significantly higher one. So it's about, are you specifying anybody wins, or is it about you specifying a person wins? That's the important part.
Okay, thank you. You're up.
Hey, John. So you mentioned a couple of different things. You talked about one race and one color of people. You talked about conflict between men and women. I wanted you to, and maybe a lack of creativity or imagination, I wanted you to comment, what do you make of the immense beauty and the complexity and diversity of the world around you?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. I crave it. I want to see more of it. I do. As a white male, I know I've got my privileges.
But why?
What?
Why?
Because every person is valuable, every person is important, and everybody should have a voice and a say and be able to express their creativity. And anybody who puts down on them because they have privilege and the others don't is a mean-spirited person that I want to be with. Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, this is for both. Two-part question. One is, what are your thoughts on why the physical world obeys the laws of mathematics, which is conceptual and abstract? And B, where B equals two, where do the laws of mathematics come from? And I'm looking at it in the design angle.
As quick as you guys can.
Oh, I give it to Scott. He has the answer.
So I will say that I think that this question hints towards the idea of, is there an argument from the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in talking about our world? I don't actually see the force of this argument myself. I know philosophers that I respect greatly do. I don't. In my opinion, I actually agree with John. John has in other debates said, the laws of logic are not necessarily great indicators that God exists. Perhaps these are simply ways that we've come to describing the world that we subsequently quantified in modes of thinking that turned out to be predictive and good. Now, I think I agree with John on that one. So I don't argue from the laws of logic saying there has to be a God, because I don't think logic comes in laws. I think that these are merely descriptions of how God thinks. And more frequently, when we think in ways more similar to the way God thinks, we turn out to be right. And this kind of right thinking, it has very close parallels to right development of mathematical models that fit the universe. So the fact that the gravity is an inverse square law isn't because I think reality has to conform to a mathematical model in order to exist. I think it's a good description of the way God made the world. And the fact that it's comprehensible to us indicates that we have a mind, and that mind may have some key similarities to the same mind that designed it because we can comprehend it. And I think that's a more fruitful line of inquiry. So I appreciate the question. I agree with half of it. Can I agree with half of the question? Okay. Thank you.
John, do you want to add on to that?
No, it's good.
No, you're good? Okay.
Thank you. Hello, sir. Thank you so much for coming this evening. The question I have is, why do you believe in evolution?
One answer, evidence.
Which evidence would that be?
Well, it's every science surrounding biology or animal science requires it. I mean, to understand animals and bodies. What have you read on the subject? Have you read anything by Dawkins or Jerry Coyne?
Well, my question is, where's the missing link that would definitively show that there was a jump from this alleged shared ancestor to the current species that we are?
Well, some of them are being discovered. I mean, I'm not the kind of scientist that can spout off this evidence. You talk to scientists who have studied it, like Jerry Coyne or Richard Dawkins, but sometimes the missing links do end up being found, but they are so transitory as, you know, as evolution moves on, they disappear. You know, they just goes quickly because it requires quickness. That's what I know.
Well, are you aware that, for example, the Lucy exhibit in London ended up just being a chimpanzee?
Okay, last part of the question.
Yes,
yeah.
So my question is, it seemed that in the discussion you weren't referring to evolution as the theory of evolution, but you were asserting it as a fact. And are there any eyewitness accounts that have observed evolution and can attest to what they saw?
Yeah, Dawkins mentioned an experiment with feces, believe it or not. And they were putting in one jar, and every day they put a little piece over here, a little piece over there, and they actually discovered evolution in fact. Read it. It's in the greatest show.
No, I mean, are there any eyewitness accounts of people who have actually observed in real time the process of evolution? And if not, why do you believe it with such certainty?
The evidence.
Well,
okay. Yeah.
The Gospels are eyewitness accounts for men who are willing to die for that truth.
They were not. They're anything but eyewitnesses. The Gospel, four Gospels were not written by eyewitnesses.
Matthew was.
Ma'am, I'm going to have to ask you to step away from the microphone.
I'll tell you why they weren't eyewitnesses, because everything in those Gospels comes second-handed at best. Every story, every parable is told to us by Matthew or Luke or Mark, not by Jesus or Paul or anyone else, because they're the ones relating it to us. The only people who are witnessing in those Gospels are the authors themselves.
One of your first premises was something that something can't come from nothing. And when I'm talking to my son about this, his biggest thing is, well, where did God come from if everything has to have a beginning? How do I answer him on that?
Yeah, that, it's a good observation, but a lot of people understandably miss a very tight nuance here. So what the premise actually says, if the universe began to exist, then the universe has a cause. So not all things in philosophy begin to exist. So some abstract objects, Platonic objects, some mathematicians are sometimes said to be Platonists on the work week and realists on the weekend. But they are the ideas of abstract objects that are eternal truths would be things that don't come into existence. I think they're mind-dependent objects, but God is not a caused being. God is necessarily the origin of all the causes because he exists necessarily. Necessary existence means God cannot fail to exist. So if it were the case that God came into being, then he would need a cause. It would be special pleading to say, anything that comes into being needs a cause, except for God. God came into being, but he doesn't need a cause. What the Christian philosopher's argument is, God is an uncaused being. And this is not particular to Christianity. I mean, for a long time, atheists said the universe was uncaused and a brute fact that existed eternally. But thank goodness modern science showed that to be unsupportable from a scientific perspective.
Okay, this will be the last question. However, and I'm sorry to put you guys on the spot in front of 600 people, but if you have time to hang around for a bit, I'm sure some people would like to talk to you, if you're able to. And if you're not, we totally understand. Last question.
How you doing, John?
Good.
Kind of a quick two-part question here. Are you a believer in the Big Bang Theory?
No.
You're not?
I think it happened, but I don't think I believe it. I think the evidence shows it.
Okay, so I was taught in science class in school that matter cannot be created nor be destroyed, and that's a scientific law. So if that's the case, why do you believe in the Big Bang, that matter just was created?
Well, the initial conditions are different than normal science, that's why.
So the law changes?
No, we don't understand it. I mean, we don't. Just you can't. And I'm not a scientist. Go ask a scientist.
Okay.
If Scott? I may, is Scott? It okay if we ask Scott the same question? Do you want to touch that before we close out?
I think we can. I think I wouldn't agree with the way exactly John said it, but it would be nitpicky on my part. I do think that what John's hinting at is the scientific idea of matter in a closed system is neither created nor destroyed. There's ways to turn around and say, well, this universe may not be a closed system. So if this is a part of a multiverse, then and that they were, let's say, some sort of brain world that interacted with this, then it's possible to say matter could come into existence in this region that was caused by something else, by effects or causes in another region of space. So matter can be neither created nor destroyed. It's really more meant to say that you can convert matter to energy and energy into matter, but you don't lose anything having done so, nor can you wink matter out of this universe. So I think John was saying this, basically, which is contained within the universe, matter is neither created nor destroyed. That law was not meant to say, therefore, all matter and energy could not have been created. That's not the scientific intent, and it was not the philosophical assumptions that people make when they make that statement. So I think I agree with John.
Boy, we covered a lot tonight, but we're just scratching the surface of so many things. So how about a tremendous round of applause for these guys? Pastor Bruce has a few announcements as we close out.
For those of you that are in line, stay in line, because after we close out, John will hang around and maybe you can get a chance to ask your question to him, and the same with Scott if you'd like, so do that. There is one thing I know all of us agree on, whether you're a student here in the front row chairs or you're a very old retiree, and that is this: how glad we are that we don't have an exam next week to where for an hour we have to summarize and write each man's opinions on the questions that were asked. We all rejoice in that. So let me close this in a word of prayer. Again, thank you all so much for how polite you were, except I told you to hold applause till the end. But you were very polite. I'm really grateful for you, and hope you have a good evening. Holy Father and Lord Jesus Christ, I ask that you would give and grant everybody a safe ride home, a wonderful sleep, and protection as they go about their lives tomorrow. And thank you again for the evening that you provided for us through these two men. And we thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you, President.